Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love, coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where our guest today is Sharon Virts, and we're going to be talking about her debut historical novel, Mask of Honor, which is a Book Reporter Betson selection. So welcome, Sharon. So nice to have you here.
Thank you so much, Carol, for inviting me here today. I'm just so honored to be here with you.
I want to start with your inspiration for Mask of Honor because it came from a very interesting place, literally the home you restored. So tell us about that. I have never heard of a book coming out of a home.
Well, this house talks to you, and you'll hear about that later, I'm sure. But my husband and I bought this house. It's called Selma. It is the manor home in which the antagonist of the book actually, you know, built and lived in as well. And it was dilapidated. It was a historic property. Part of it was built in 1810. And then it was rebuilt. Part of it was rebuilt again in 1902. And it had been abandoned for, 20 years. Ivy growing in, you know, varmints and vultures and you name it. We had it living here. And it wasn't for sale. I saw it on Facebook. A friend of mine from college had posted on her site, and I knew the house because I grew up just 3 miles from here. And we bought it. We found the owner and we convinced him to sell it to us. And then we restored it. And it's we moved in about 15 months after we started, but only one floor was done. We only had kitchen and, because if I wasn't here like running rampshod over these construction guys, it never would have been finished.
Exactly.
Restored, and it's beautiful. And we tried to put it back the way it was, when it was, first built.
Wow. How long did that take?
Like I said, we bought it in March of 16, and my husband and I moved in in July of 18. I'm sorry, wow. 16, July of 17. And then major construction was still ongoing for another year. So I'd say about 2.5 years.
Wow.
Just hard. I had 60, guys up here at any given time for the first year.
Wow. So you started here about the original owner of the house. Is that what got you thinking about the story?
Yes. So Armistead Mason was a general and a senator, and the local lore around here was he this great, big, huge hero. As a matter of fact, my great, great, great grandfather served under his command during the War of 1812. He was one of those Quakers that you read about, or those Dunkards, actually. Dunkards you read about in the book. But his story was interesting, the story of his duel, how he came into office, and the more I uncovered about that story, the more intrigued I became. And what prompted me to actually write it was I'm on a board of a film festival here, the Middleburg Film Festival, and Anthony McCartan is a friend of mine. Anthony McCartan, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but a famous screenwriter. He wrote The Darkest Hour, he wrote Bohemian Rhapsody. Mm-hmm. We were imbibing in adult beverages one evening, and he said, you got to write it, Sharon. You just have to write that story. Just do it. Just write it. It's like so interesting. And so, he kind of pushed me in that direction, and I started researching, more in depth, and I put the first word on paper on February 1st in 2018. So.
And kept going from there. Yeah. So did you feel like the walls were talking to you, like as you were exploring the history? Did you feel like as you're walking through the house, this is where they were?
There's a lot of that, especially in the old section, the 1810 section. I used to say to people, they said, oh, those walls could talk. And I said, well, if they did, I'm running the other direction. But they do. There is a spirit here. There is, and people think I'm crazy, but I felt it. There is a chapter in the book, Mask of Honor. It's the chapter, the Beauty and the Beast chapter, if you're familiar with that one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That chapter, I swear I didn't write. I sat in the room. My husband was out of town. I started working on it probably around 5:30. The next thing I know, it's 2:00 in the morning and it's written. And I really don't remember writing it. I just typed it and it just sort of came to me. And I read it the next day. I was like, oh my gosh, this is not bad. And I researched, and sure enough, the Beauty and the Beast rhyme or fable was written in 1740 or something. So I was good on that.
At least it had been done.
Yeah, I do. I do feel like it sort of, the universe just sort of opens up and it just comes through you. And this house has got a lot of great karma and a lot of great stories. And it's not just Mask of Honor, there's others that, you know, during the war, the Civil War and thereafter, those stories I think are still alive in these walls and you can sense it.
Wow, wow. You know, one of my author friends is restoring a home down on Tybee Island. And the other day she took out something on the wall and she found a wallet. And she found all these cards of this person in the wallet. And she started to track down who it was. And she's been uncovering it on Instagram and Facebook. And it's been very interesting to see. We pulled out a cabinet here and our house is not that old. And we saw just a picture, like a Polaroid picture. And we looked and we realized it was the original owners of the house. And I contacted the son and I said, is this your parents? And he was saying, yes, this was that year. And then started to tell us our house is not that old, about the history. And it's fun though, when you hear like things that you just didn't know about a house, because a house has its own personality. The people come and live in and out of it. Right. The house remains, you know?
Right. I just recently just was researching. So the Bentley family, the Beverly family owned it from about the 1840s till about 1891 or something. And I was just kind of curious about them because we're working on updating our website for this home as well. And I ran into a Robert Bentley, if you trace him back to Jamestown, and he was part of this Green Spring movement. If you know anything about the Bacon's, you know, rebellion that was going on during this, the 1670s. And there was a woman that he worked with named Lady Beverly, who has got another very interesting story. I said, oh my God, Lady Berkeley, another interesting story. So, oh my gosh, to be more fodder, you know, you just don't know paths take you when you start to really research.
Yeah.
It also has so many interesting connections.
So one of the family members from great, 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 great back shared some story with you. How did you two meet up? And did you meet in person or was it just in correspondence?
So it was just through email, but what's interesting is that, you know, people ask me, I'm doing an article right now for a blog about how to research historical fiction, you know, successfully. And I use ancestry.com a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm really curious about birth order and when a person got married or when their spouse died or when their parents died or all those things. It helps me sort of unpack them. And I was researching Jack McCarty and this guy had posted stuff about his family on Ancestry. So I sent a note to him through ancestry.com and he got back to me and then we connected via email. His name's Jared Banta. He is fabulous, wonderful guy. Lives out in Los Angeles. He does scores for movies as a director and musical scores. And he shared with me some writings of his great, great, great grandmother who would be Jack's daughter. It helped me learn about some of the characters and about the mindset, that she had of how she saw the duel, how she saw her father, and some of the family members that she interacted with when she was young. Really interesting.
And what I did love in the book is that at the beginning you have like who's who. You have like this, you know, graph of like, you know, so you can follow this these charts of who everybody is. And I love that because a lot of times it's like, who are these characters? And right. Where do they go from there? Was that something you always wanted to do or did that come up later on?
Well, originally I had a cast of characters in there and who was related to who that way. And one of the editors at Reddit said, this is very confusing. And of course it was like 4 pages long and they said, you're just gonna intimidate your readers with all that. And so we said, let's put in a sort of a genealogy chart of who mm-hmm. related. And we tried to put, because I know there's relationships with George Washington in the book, but it became more convoluted. So I didn't want it to get too big, but I thought that was helpful. So you could see too, you know, the sisters and the siblings and the spouses and this webkin thing we have going on in a lot of the first families of Virginia. So that sort of showed that as well.
Right. So you did start out to be a writer. You had a whole other career that we'll talk about a little bit later on, a whole different career. Did you always think about becoming a writer? Or when somebody just sat there and said, oh, you're a writer, I'm like, really? I am? I never thought about that.
Well, it was on my bucket list. I always wanted to write a book. I mean, since I can remember, you know, when I first started my own company, I said, I'm going to write a book. And at first I thought it was going to be a book about, you know, how to do what we did. And I was the first business I sort of ran, it was a sort of a consulting firm, how to be a successful consultant. That was kind of boring. And then, you know, when I built my firm, I think we discussed this before, you know, when I sold it, we had 5,000 employees. And I started that company in my basement twice. another story, but I thought it was going to be, my book would be a memoir of how to build a business from nothing. How do you go about doing that? Especially being a woman, a largely predominantly government contracting male dominated world. So that's what I thought I would do. And I never thought I would write, you know, fiction or historical fiction. Yeah. But I always loved history. So that sort of makes sense, I suppose.
So loving history, did you like history when you were in school? Was that something that you really, was that your favorite class? Let's put it that way.
No, I it was not my favorite class. I don't know if I had a favorite class. I loved English, but I think my my father and my grandmother and the stories that they would tell really helped cement that. My family's been in Virginia since the 1750s. We were those Dunkards that live out in the German settlement. When, you know, people died, they inherited their houses and all the stuff. So we have Bible back to 1770 and a lot of those artifacts. And so, you know, my father's into genealogy as well. And so all those things I sort of came together and listening to them tell stories of, you know, your great, great, great grandfather was, you know, somebody tried to steal his boots during the Civil War, because we, even though we were in Virginia, we were unionists. Believe in the Institute of Slavery, and we're very religious folks. And so therefore, you know, we were in a really bad spot living in Virginia, being unionists. So there's lots of stories about, you know, the Confederate raids on my family's farms. And I think that sort of prompted that love of history and love of the past. And I feel like I relate to it.
I also feel like history told through story like that is completely different than story told through books. I mean, I say that when you're in school, you learn there was a battle, who won the battle, who was the general, what year. That's basically the test, those four questions.
Right.
And it really has nothing to do with the much larger picture of what's going on in history. And I think it's the reason I enjoy historical fiction, because you have characters, you're shaping the book around those characters, but you're getting to know the time and place. It's not just so-and-so went off to battle, so-and-so went off to a duel. This is what led to that. Because in your book, that's what we're leading up towards. We're leading up to this duel that ends up happening. But it's why that happens, how they try not to, you know?
It's the question why. And I will tell you, one of my sons, who's a big history buff as well, he'll ask you something like, so what happened in 1492? And people say, Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue. The question is why? Why was he sailing the ocean blue? The reason was the Silk Road, right? And all that was going on and trying to find cheaper trade routes to usurp that Silk Road. It's that question why, right? Mm-hmm. Why behind any historical event comes down to mostly people, mentality, people, and who's in charge. And it's a different layer than what you would learn in a history book. And that's what I love about it is unpacking that why. People are doing, why they are motivated in this book. Why in the world, it bugged me to no end, why would Armistead give up a seat in the Senate to campaign for a seat in the House? And when you start tearing it apart, you begin to uncover, you know, the true motivation was to, you know, rid themselves of the Republican Party, you know, to put a final nail on that coffin. And you know, you don't get that from history books. You don't get that those nuances. And that's what I love about historical fiction is that hopefully these stories that not just myself, but other great authors write, give us that insight into the why. That the facts are just, the events are just the background, you know? It's gotta be embedded as part of the story and the people.
Yeah, my older son is on the historic committee here in town. And he's always so interesting when he comes home from meetings and he's talking about, well, this farm was here and why it really moved and why this became a development and the buildings that they still look over in our town. If anything is knocked down of such and such year, they should be able to go in and see if there are any artifacts or anything in there.
Right.
Because so much is not preserved these days. It's just knocked down. Let's move on. Let's put up a big mansion. Let's do whatever. And you lose a lot of the culture and the feel of what's going on in the town.
And in this area in Virginia, here where we are, what is one of the biggest travesties, and I've been working with a friend of mine who's the head of the NAACP local here, the destruction of the burial grounds for the enslaved. Mm-hmm. In the past, they just dug them up, built roads over them. Nobody cared, right? They just didn't. And recently there's been a lot more emphasis on making sure we find those and preserve those. But that's another travesty, right? The story of those folks and the enslaved and and just the way we just build, like I said, just mow down and build over.
Yeah. I was like, okay, that's a cemetery. Okay, we really don't need to be doing that anymore. That's right. That's not important anymore. You know, did you have a favorite character when you were writing the book? Was there one that you...
Oh, you mean besides Jack?
Besides Jack. Like, we totally got it as Jack.
Well, you know what's funny is that who ended up becoming my favorite character, besides Jack, because poor Jack, you know, can't catch a break. She became my favorite character as I wrote her. And Jared Banta, who we spoke about earlier, the great-great-grandson of Jack, helped me identify her. And it was Emily Hardy, William's wife. You know, she comes across as a little flighty in the beginning, but she really is the peacemaker. She really is the catalyst. She really is the strength. I think, in terms of that family, in a lot of ways, but subtly so, I think she was underestimated, but she was progressive, which I liked her thinking in terms of, you know, women, we have a voice and I'm going to interrupt you no matter whether you like it or not. I her grave is not too far from here. And I do visit her every now and then, but I think with
thinking about that,
do you have a favorite?
No, I was going back and I was thinking Jack, definitely, because Jack's got spunk and, you know, Jack's just Jack. Let's get real. I was casting Jack in my head and I usually don't do that. But I thought Lucinda was interesting though, too. I thought that there were women that were sort of trapped in their roles in a lot of ways. And I find it very interesting because they're in those roles they don't want to be, but there's nothing they can do. Like, they're kind of powerless. And to watch that they want to break free of where they are and there's no way they can. And it's no matter what they try, they think they're so clever. I think that's the part that really amuses me, is they think they're so clever. They're going to outwit the guys. They're going to outwit the rest of the family. And it just never happens. It's just, this is your role. This is what you're going to do. Am I crazy?
She was the hardest character for me to write.
Yeah.
The more I learned about her, that she didn't have that inheritance, pretty much. It's questionable if her mother was able to pay it off at some point, but it looked like she didn't have an inheritance. And I know for a fact from the writings that I've read that Jack had proposed to her and he was like one of the wealthiest guys. And she said no. So, and the first time anyway. And you ask yourself, why would she say no? And so I built that character around her being stronger and having that different thinking. And she was hard to write, but she was, you know, definitely complicated.
She's the one that, though, you sit there and you want to know what she's going to do next because you don't know. Like, right. You have no idea what she's going to do, what she's going to run into at all. That's the way I felt when I was reading her. So forgiveness is a big theme in the book. And how did that impact your characters? Because there's a lot of having to forgive, ask for forgiveness, or be willing to be forgiven or forgive.
Correct. Right. So, we'll start with Jack since he is the protagonist. And by the way, you know, he wasn't the original protagonist. I thought Armistead was going to be.
Oh, okay.
When I learned more about him. And the more I learned about him, I was like, okay, we're going to have to switch this about a little bit. But with Jack, he had to learn to forgive himself. That was his hardest thing, you know. And there's a line toward the end of the book, I think, where he says something like, you know, he sees these orphan children playing. And he asks himself a question, you know, was I ever that happy? And the answer to his next question, why not, is the one that changed everything. So why wasn't he happy? It's because he hadn't learned to accept himself. He hadn't learned to forgive himself. And he had been a bad boy for a long time. So I think that was, you know, kind of his role. Armistead, he couldn't forgive anyone, right? I mean, he had scorecards, obviously. it ended up costing him in a lot of ways. But forgiveness for Lucinda, I think, was she had to learn to forgive her past. It really had a big impact on her. And of course there's Emily, who I think was pretty forgiving of everyone. But she held them accountable, but she also understood the power of forgiving in order to move forward and have happiness. So I think there's all those things. It's a theme throughout, and it played, I think, very heavily in terms of the plot and where the characters end up by the time you get to the end of the book.
You know, by the time you're like finished, it's like everybody had a different role and their roles shift. They like shape shift as time's going on as well, of who learns what and who becomes stronger and who becomes less powerful. That's what I would be seeing.
And, you know, I think power. Great theme for today in terms of the power of forgiveness. We can be different. We can have different views, but we need to learn to forgive ourselves and forgive others. And move forward, because otherwise we're living in the past, and it doesn't get us anywhere. Kind of what the point of this was, you know, you don't get anywhere by doing that.
So without giving any away, was there someone you were cheering for in the duel, or you gave it away?
Well, unfortunately, I knew how it ended. What it's more of the interesting part was when you actually read the documents. I had narrowed down these exchanges and these threats of fighting one another to a couple. There were lots more. It went on for a long time. So, you know, just by reading the docs, you knew it was going to end up that way. You know, I would have loved for them both to have sort of shook hands and walked away, but then there wouldn't have been a story.
Would have been the same thing. So all these wonderful scenes, all the period details, as you were researching, did you say, I can't keep this all? I can't keep all this information. And was it hard to let go of what you know is a great scene or a great thing just to set up, just to make the story work?
Well, yes. So that was the hardest part. So I knew in the beginning I couldn't have all those exchanges because it was just going to, you know, bog the story down. So I knew I had to consolidate letters and consolidate and just trying to read the letters and, you know, get them down to where you and I could understand what they were saying because they wrote passively. I knew I had to do all that. But the toughest thing was changing the facts as I knew them to make the story work or changing the timeline. Yeah, I didn't have much experience in doing that. And I wanted to stay true to the story, but I also learned that if the story drags and no one will read it, and then what good is it to tell it if no one reads it? So my sort of mantra became stay true to the spirit of the story. Mm-hmm. And write fiction in a way in which you want to keep turning the pages. So I did leave things out and I did consolidate and I did, you know, I added stuff that I, you know, that I don't know to be true. To make it for good storytelling. So yeah, it was hard for me to do that. And I'm sure there's other authors will tell you the same thing. It's the toughest thing to do, to change a fact, to change, you know, an event to make it work. But I think my way out is the author's notes.
Then yes.
what I've done. But yeah, it's hard. It's a hard pill to swallow for me.
Yeah. The author's notes are like confession, you know, forgive me, Father, I have sinned. You know, forgive me, reader, I have sinned.
And hopefully I remembered every sin I committed, because I'm sure there's more than one. After a while, you just forget, right? As you know, Carol, this book was originally 226,000 words.
I know.
And it closed at 106. So you know a lot of things got cut.
A lot of things are on the cutting room floor, but the story did not suffer for it, you know? You know, I confess to binging on Bridgerton recently on Netflix. Ah. I mean, I just sat there. And when I was rereading Mask of Honor, because I'd read it much earlier for this interview, I realized they were in the same time period. I didn't really think about that. And life was so very different, you know, with the multiple changes of outfits a day and what I call the lockjaw over talking, because they don't say a lot of things. They just snub people. They just, like, you know, cut you out. I mean, it's a big thing. Both that show and here about cutting people out, like we just will not invite them or whatever. When writing your characters, were you thinking a lot about the voice? Because the voice is what carries through. People didn't talk then the way they talk now. It's right. Like, you know, I must not see her or something like that. Now it'd be completely different. Was staying in the voice like really important to you too?
Yes. Well, first off, I'm one of these crazy people. When I set a scene up, I start with dialogue. I hear it in my head, how they're talking to one another, or what they're saying to one another. And so I write snippets of, I'm like working on a new book now and I'm writing snippets of dialogue, you know, next to the chapters I'm thinking about. So I think in terms of dialogue, so that's easier for me, I think. Mm-hmm. If you've noticed Mask, it's got a lot of dialogue because that's the way I think and the way I write. But absolutely I have a way that I hear them speak. Emily being kind of disjointed in her talk, and you need strings to keep track of where she's going, and Armistead being so, you know, poofy and just, you know, overly whatever. And I have fights with my editor over that, because they want to change my cannots to can'ts or my to won't. I'm like, you can't do that, because he wouldn't say, you know, won't, I won't go there. He's like, I will not go there, like you said.
Right. Right.
But yeah, it's in my head. It truly is my head. And I hope I try to reflect that in some of the dialogue. you know, you can't have it overly passive or no one will read it. Mm-hmm. They talked very passively. But you also have to keep it modern enough so that we can understand it and we get it. And trying to keep the cliches out is also very hard, you know, because some of the things that they said would be considered cliches today. So yeah, I think in terms of the voice, yeah, I'm very conscious of it.
It was very different dialogue. It was just these very stiff people walking around where we would just say things. It was, well, I don't know how I feel about them coming to dinner. It's like, are they coming over or not? Is what we would say. And it's very hard. And it is true. There weren't contractions. That wasn't what it was. Very crisp English on what to say and bravado. You know, it was just
different. And innuendo. You know, and sometimes my innuendo was too subtle and I'd had to have to explain it, but the innuendo, really important as well. You know, there's the north end, south end scene. If you remember Lucinda and Jack's banter,
yes,
surveying his north end and south end. I'm not quite sure, but I try to make that, you know, filled with innuendo. So, you know, things that they couldn't say out loud that we might be able to say today in terms of flirting. But the subtleties of some of the language is important to get across as well.
Yeah, and romance plays a big part in Mask of Honor. And was that there from the start? Was it the male characters at the beginning and then looking at their world, or was the whole thing?
When I first read, there's a really great article that was written in the 1890s, I think, 1880s, by someone who was a child when the duel happened. And his mother was friends with Charlotte Armistead's wife. And there is a discussion in his writings about Lucinda Lee and the romance with Jack and how, you know, he almost lost her as a result of the duel. And then afterwards, what happened. And then, of course, Charlotte's as well, you know, her reaction to things. So those women were from the beginning in there. I just had to come up with the personalities that went with them. I used, you know, ancestry.com, a lot of, you know, birth order and when they lost their fathers and then reading about their fathers and their brothers and reading their brothers' writings, if I could get my hands on it, to sort of understand women. Women are hard to get them right.
They didn't have a voice for a long time. The writings that they did were not the writings of men that are historical documents that were preserved. And, you know, when you think about this, you said you were reading all these writings, you were reading whatever. Think about how much today is an email that is no record whatsoever. I was going through some boxes because, you know, there was pandemic cleaning going on. We didn't move. We've lived here too long. We have too much crap. So I was upstairs, but I was finding when I worked at a company 25 years ago, and I have no idea why I still save these. But it was people getting promotions, like the notes that were written about them. The thing, now it's an email blast that goes out to the company. There's no history kinds of little even pieces like that. There are even a lot less Christmas cards these days. There's a lot less of, I was plucking out people's pictures of their children. I mean, we have stuff that I was going back and I had a birth announcement of a friend whose child is now 31. I mean, yes, I did throw nothing out, but to see those moments that we don't have anymore because everything is like even trying to track down family pictures. Who's got it on their camera? Who's got it on their phone? How do we do that? Very different.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, my IT guy will tell you this. I never delete an email. Mm-hmm. Crazy. I keep them all and I have them all. I have every email I think I've ever written since probably 2003. Mm-hmm. I keep them. I'm one of those people. I'm holding on to it. So I've got them all backed up and here I can get to them if I need them. For that very reason, because it's sort of like the documentation of your life, and then other people's lives and world. So I hold on to them. I'm a pack rat, obviously. I mean, I could move my camera around and show you some of my rat stuff that's in this room.
It's like all these pieces are
right. But you're right. I mean, we don't have the same ability, you know, in terms of those writing those shoe boxes full of letters that it's all electronic.
No, and you also could see their handwriting. You could see whether it was tense. You could see whether it was loose, how they were writing, because it was all not typed. It was all not perfect. It was, you know, scratch out or like, you know, cleaned up with the ink blot or whatever. It's just such a different way of thinking. And here, everything is immediate. Everything, we think about social media right now. Think about anything that's going on right now. Everything is to the minute. And what I say a lot is whoever's witty or edgy or whatever is the one that's getting paid attention. But sometimes the thoughtful sit back and have a conversation is not part of the dialogue right now, because everything is about being like smart and witty and come out with this line and what's going to get picked up and what's going to go viral. And what, and you realize looking at this, that's not what they were looking at. It's all clickbait. It's all like just getting you to the next point. Whereas what's the real story of what's going on? Like you, where is really the story? And it's too much. We're told in all these little bits and bytes of like what's really going on. I don't know, it's an interesting time, but to not have that to go back to, like it must've been fascinating just to be doing the research and just see what did these people say? How were they talking?
Right. And then what I, you know, I always worry about what I missed, you know, cause where to go to look. I mean, there's stuff buried everywhere. You know, this library, that library. The amount of newspapers I have gone through on microfiche. You asked me, I think someone asked me about the costumes, how to come up with some of the costumes and that thing. And I said, I looked at advertisements. I would go into the newspapers and I would look at the advertisements, or I get magazines that they were published. You know, thank God for the internet, right? Because, and otherwise you'd never get it all. But when I had to go to the Virginia Library down to Richmond and then sit it there for hours in front of those microfiche machines, and you got to, they're not indexed. You got to just go through it, right? But yeah, getting your head back into that time is really through what they had then, which their social media was, you know, the trades, the papers, but finding things on women has been always a real challenge, you know?
But you also remember the mail came every day, twice a day, right? As opposed to now, maybe it's going to arrive, possibly, you're not really sure. It's like, the way they had the mail under control compared to now is the one that always surprises me. My son is out in Utah right now. He's out on a photo trip about shooting. And he stopped by the ski museum last night. And he was showing me pictures from the ski museum. He goes, it looks like your closet of ski clothes, because I still have my stuff from like the 70s and 80s. And he's like, look, he said, it looks just like your house. And I was like, very funny, very
funny. You're like me, Kira. I'm a pack rat. I got everything. I mean, yeah, I got two storage bins, and listen to this house of stuff. I can't get rid of anything.
Well, it's funny because we went skiing a couple of years ago and I wore the clothes and people were coming up and wanted to buy them off us because they were vintage. And my husband said, who knew we were vintage? Like funding the trip by selling our clothes. Who knew? I was like, I'm not going to buy anything new. You know, you were a very successful corporate executive with, you know, bottom line responsibility, 5,000 employees. What skills did you take from running a company that you brought to your writing? Because discipline?
Oh, definitely discipline. I'm very disciplined. Schedules and deadlines, man, I live by schedules and deadlines. And so I make deadlines for myself. I, you know, hold myself accountable. I try to hold other people accountable as well. You know, my editor, she wants to kill me from time to time. I'm sure I'm like, okay, Deb, it's time, you know, it's due. So there's definitely that. I think also during that editing process, you learn as an executive, it doesn't really matter whether you authored it or someone else authored it. It matters in proposal development when you're bidding on these big, large $400 million programs for the federal government. You have to have a proposal that wins. And you've got to be able to cut, you know, your babies. You got to be able to kill your sacred cows, because at the end of the day, it's about getting it right. And so learning that no pride in authorship, no ego when it comes to that, just whatever it's, like you said, do what you need to do it right from the beginning. Otherwise, you know, you won't have anything that's wants to buy. So listening to that was really important. And I think most of all is people. You know, I built a very large company, one contract, one person at a time, right? And people, you understand what motivates people, people think, how people react. I think that understanding of people, you know, that I learned just from running a business and running a lot of people, a very people intensive business, helps, you know, in terms of understanding character and what motivates people and what, you know, upsets people. And then of course, on the sales side, as we move and we roll, because Mass comes out next week, I get very frustrated when I find out in the publishing business, there are no such things as key performance indicators.
And well, maybe I can't have those. Key performance indicators. I love it. I think we should bring those to publishing, everybody.
Key performance indicators. There's no rhyme or reason to any of it. And I was talking to some of my folks in New York yesterday on the advertising side, and they're like, oh, we can't really tell you if you hit this audience, how many you're going to end up selling. I'm like, guys, how do you run businesses like this without like any metrics? I don't understand.
what are the click-throughs going to be, and how will that result in sales? And
like everything's new. I'm like, everything's its own thing. I'm like, it can't be. I'm going to figure this out.
This is what you're going to bring to publishing. Besides being an author, it's like, where's the accountability? We need this right, accountability. You write the very strong male characters. Do you think that some of your previous work influenced that too? Like, I've got to get the deal. Do you understand? I'm going to be terribly sexist here, but like the male psyche when it comes to that, because that's who you were bidding against, I'm sure.
Yeah. I understand men. Well, first off, I raised four boys.
Right.
Now, so I have that experience and my boys will tell you that there's different pieces of their personality in each one of those major four McCarty boys. But I think that what's unique about it is that I feel more comfortable writing men than women. I think like them in some ways, but I also understand their emotions, and, you know, how to expose their vulnerabilities in the writing so that you and I, women readers, can relate to them better. And I also think writing to men the way I write them helps make those supporting characters, those supporting women, stronger, because, you know, you're watching, for example, Sally McCarty understand what motivates her son and how to get to him. And those two scenes with Polly talking to Armistead, Polly's mother, Armistead's mother's Polly, obviously, and then Sally, Jack's mother, talking to Jack about they shouldn't be dueling. Those women take the approach in different ways, and they know exactly how to push their son's buttons. And I tried to capture what those boys were feeling and why they were responding the way they were, only that a woman, I think, can understand. Because I think oftentimes, and probably all the male readers are going to shoot me for saying this, but I think a lot of men don't want to look at those deep, deep, deep inner circle emotions and those vulnerabilities, and don't want to expose them. They don't want us to know anything about them at all. And I enjoy writing them. In my next book, you'll find I got another male protagonist. The women around him are strong, because I think in that time, in the 19th century, we had to have, you know, strong women. Men had to have strong women around them because women didn't have a voice. And what else did they have to do but influence, right? Influence their men in order to get their way. I mean, they couldn't do it on their own oftentimes. That's a struggle with this sort of time period. We were just silenced. I don't know how I would have survived.
I don't think I would have either. I would have burned at the stake or something like that for saying something.
Right, but they had to live through the men in their lives. And I think when you look at some of the writings of some of these men and some of the ambitions they have, I often wonder is how much did their mother or how much did their spouse or how much did their sisters have to do with where they are and why things a certain way. And so I like to give the credit to the women in some of that. And that's what I try to show in this book when I write these men.
And it's interesting too, because at the beginning, Sally is like, she's called Sally. She's not called mom by her children. Right. And big line is, you know, like Sally, they're in the carriage and she's all perfectly coiffed and ready to go, but it's not mom. And she doesn't want to be called mom. That's the way you address me. And it's very different because it's how she's seeing to herself and her role, how she's seeing herself and what she does.
I love Sally, by the way.
I could tell. Yeah. It Mask Bonner's perfect title for this book. Was that the original title? Was that always your working title?
No. Okay. So this is a big confession. So originally I was going to call it Affair of Honor. And then, cause that's what they fought a duel, which is an affair of honor. But when you do some just do a Google on Affair of Honor and you got guys ripping their shirts off, you know, you got that, you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
It's not that kind of a book. And then at some point we talked about Blood Run because that's where the duel was fought. And then sort of gave credence to more of a thriller kind of movie, a book. It didn't feel right. So we settled on Mask. You know, me and my husband are the ones that, you know, we talk about this all the time, what to name it. So Mask of Honor in the title. And I like it because I think it really fits the shield they hide behind.
It really does, because it's you're going for your own honor, but what are you doing to get that honor? And it's who are you hiding behind? And do you really believe in what you're doing, or are you doing it out of what should be done? It's like there's a lot of should be done happening in this time period. This is the way things are done. This is the noble thing to do. This is the not noble thing to do. So,
and behind it also, you'll find in both Armistead and Jack is that they are shielding themselves. They're not exposing themselves. They're hiding behind a mask. I mean, Jack's got his pain that he's hiding behind, and Armistead as well. And so there's two scenes in the book where both of them are questioning themselves, that am I just an insignificant nothing? Back with the lightning bugs. We call them lightning bugs down here. And Armistead with the dog when he's in Richmond. And they're questioning that mask is being lowered, it's being stripped away, and it scares them to death. And I think that sort of that mask and that drama that goes around with when that mask falls, and then how they have to shore themselves up and, you know, present themselves as these big, strong, honorable guys when deep down, you know, they're vulnerable and you know, weak in some ways and scared like the rest of us. So that's what it meant.
And power is so important. And power is so important to these people.
And what other people think of you, right?
Yeah, that's exactly, totally. So the audiobook, I got to listen to a little snippet of that. Jonathan Todd Ross narrates it. Did you pick him to be the narrator?
No, well, I got to say yes to him, but it was the folks at Recorded Books presented him to me. And I heard his a sample of some work he had done for an Oliver North book called The Rifleman, which was set in during the War of 1812. And I just loved his voice. I loved the way he captured that perfect Virginia accent, not quite British, not quite Southern. It's something in between. And he nailed it. And yeah, I think he's fabulous. And I got to hear a snippet of his reading of the book just yesterday. And I get chills. It's like it's a different book. I mean, he did a fabulous job.
Yeah, it's the authoritative voice that the book needs. It's just that, you know, commanding kind of presence kind of thing. I love it. Absolutely right. Love it. So back to the restoration project of the house, because these kind of projects are not easy. Is this the first time that you've done? I mean, you did a huge house. Is this the first one you've done?
First one.
This is like baptism by fire.
So we bought this place. Well, my husband was not too keen on it, I'll just tell you. I was going to do it whether he wanted me to or not. But I said, don't worry, honey. It'll just take a little wire brush and some paint. It'll be okay. Right. Yeah, right. No, I've never done one of these before. And I just ran it like I would run a project. I put together, you know, Gantt charts and schedules and crews. And I had Monday morning meetings where I got all the heads of the crews together and make sure everybody's on the same page. And I walk around with my clipboards and establish benchmarks for how many square inches of paint you could scrape in an hour. I mean, yeah, I ran a company. I did a presentation not long ago for the Rotary Club here locally. And I showed them one of my schedules just for 1 week. And had a dozen crews. We had like 60 guys working up here, different color codes to show who was what part of the house. And their eyes, and they go, you manage that? And I said, yeah, I mean, that's what I do. I know how to manage things. And so yeah, it was quite the project.
They always love the woman on the construction project. We did our office, one of our offices in New York at one point, and they told me, and you can come home and go back in 3 weeks. Like, you could just go home. And I said, and that's your dream. That is your dream. And it's not happening. I will be
here. They were not happy when I came up here to watch what they were doing. I mean, you know, that's why we moved in early. Scott's like, we can't move into that house. It hasn't even got a kitchen. I said, you'll survive. Restaurants, take out. I said, if I'm not there every day on them, it'll be, you know, I'll still be waiting to move into this place.
So funny. At one point we decided we were going to leave the all the ductwork exposed. And I said, yes, we're going to leave it exposed, but that means not one speck of paint. It's all got to stay metal. And everybody's just looking at me. And I was like, there's, you know, we're going to do one thing or the other. Did you ever think when you're doing the house, were you ever daunted by like, what are we doing at some point with the house?
Yeah. There was, lots. I'd come home and I'd go, oh God, what am I doing? Am I doing this right? There was one particular wing. It's the 1810s wing, and it was the old original slaves quarters for the domestics. And the county wanted me to tear it down. A tree had hit it. It was falling down. It was a mess. And I just did not know how to approach that whole project. And so we went to Jamestown and brought in, brick masons who had worked down there for years. The guys' names were Cheetah and Smoke. And they had learned the trade from their great-great-grandparents who had been enslaved, I think, as well. And they taught my crew how to restore that old brick, how to rebuild it. And once you bring the experts in, and I had an architect who was wonderful, Wiley Cook. He's an older gentleman who has worked in restoring old courthouses in the past. And without him and some of these experts that we brought in, I would have never been able to do this. And so you just rely on them, you trust them, sort of guide you in terms of whether something's doable or not. But yeah, there are plenty of times when I'm in over my head. I have the internet. I say, okay, how much paint can I scrape in an hour? And then I would put benchmarks and watch these guys because they were, fiddle farting around, not doing what they're supposed to be doing. But we got it at the end.
Do you have a website for the house, did you say too?
Is there
a website?
We do. It's called Selma Mansion Rebirth. Because it was always Selma Mansion and we were trying to rebirth it because it was about to fall over and die. We have about 76,000, 75,000 followers on Facebook who would watch us every day. And right now we really don't do a whole lot. My husband and I are turning it more into an educational site about some of the historic properties that are in need of restoration, trying to document other people's restorations or at least point you to where they're working. Because I think that we're losing a big part of our history. Tear down these old places or we don't realize what we have. And they haven't got to be big, huge, houses like mine. I don't really care. They can be a one-room schoolhouse. I think that we need to do a better job of restoring things as well as, I want people to buy older homes and fix them up as opposed to buying new. And I think that there's glory in that. And the walls do talk. They do have secrets to share. And I think it's a good thing for us to keep that history alive.
Yeah. You were also an artist and I was watching your painting. You paint with a knife. You paint with a knife. If anybody goes and looks, I think it's on your Facebook page is some of your paintings. Right? Mm-hmm. Absolutely stunning work, but you were actually showing your technique of working with knife. Now I assume you were painting before you were a writer. Like I'm sure
I've
you
been
painted for years.
I was a kid. Yeah. Since I was a kid. I practice something called reflectionism. And a really dear friend of mine, J.D. Miller, has a gallery in Dallas, Texas. It's called Samuel Lynn Galleries. And he and I painted together and I've really learned a lot from him. And it really is your interpretation of the world and the universe come through you and then onto the canvas. It's dimensional, it's depth, use of color, use of your imagination to fill in the gaps. It's filled with texture. And that's what I love about it is that, it's a painting that jumps off the canvas. And I I've sort of taken that whole philosophy in terms of my writing. I want characters that have depth and have texture and that when I write them, they jump off the pages and that you're thinking about them because you're feeling their pain or you're feeling what they're going through and not just the protagonist. I think that in order for you to have a rich layers of a painting, it's not just your central focal piece, but it's all the things that happen in the fly lines and around the canvas that make that painting rich and talk to you. And I think that's the same thing with a story. It's not just Jack, but it's those supporting cast members. It's his brother William, it's his brother Edgar, it's his mother, it's his antagonist and her wife, it's all of them. They all form parts of that painting. So I kind of, when I stand back and I've painted something, I look at it for a while and say, okay, what's it missing? Or is it enough? And if I add something else in, and I do the same thing when I'm writing. And then it's interesting, you helped me, at one point, I think you said, sure, I get some of these words out of this thing. So, cutting oftentimes helps you reveal what's lying underneath. Authors shouldn't, especially historical fiction, shouldn't be afraid to cut away from what you think are important facts or events and sort of taking that, that sort of Hemingway approach of letting the iceberg, sort of show just what it shows. And then the depth is really underneath.
It's like when you're painting, what I was thinking is the enough white space, there has to be enough white space around or enough of the other color to let what you're really doing in the image stand out. And so many times there's so much going on that you miss what the really important point is. And I just saw in the writing as well, it's like, you got to go in for what they really need to know. They need to know everything. You need to know everything to write it. They don't need to read it. Right. So you've also done something interesting with a book and wine club on your website. And you've been reading a lot of historical fiction and a number of different books. I think you did the V.E. Schwab book, The Secret Life of
Ed. We're doing that this month, actually. This month. Yeah. I loved it, by the way. I know it's exactly historical fiction, but I said, hey, if she's been living 300 years, it counts.
It's all cash. She keeps coming back. Yep. And no one knows who she is. You just love this. Nobody knows who she is. So what are some of the other books you discussed, and what brought you to say, let me do a book club? Is to understand the market better, or no, understand book lovers?
Yes and no. This comes from my business days, is that, you know, I have a following already, but I got to make sure they appreciate historical fiction. So they'll buy my book and they'll appreciate it, you know, in contrast with others. And so you build your market, right? And that's what I'm trying to do, is reach out and build my market, but also helping other authors. I've got tons of followers, but I have 740 some odd people that are actually book club members, that they get book bags and they get treats and tchotchkes I send to them, and they buy the book and they tag along. And I think we had 40 some odd people in our book club discussion last month. I mean, that's a lot for me to manage, but that's, you know, then others are sending questions in that aren't on the Zoom call. So, you know, it's a way for us to sort of connect with others and then make sure that my audience appreciates not just what I'm doing, but what others are doing. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, we can help each other. And some of the great books we've read, I mean, it's been a ton, but I'm a huge fan of Diane Chamberlain's. Mm-hmm. Her book last year. I'm waiting for a book next year. I'm so excited about that. It was Big Lies in a Small Town we read, which is historical enough. And I love her depth of characters that she puts in her books.
And it had the painting in it. And
yes, that's another thing.
So it totally worked. I love that book. I love that book because there was such a complex story and how she was going to peel it back to get to where you wanted to be. It was a good study in writing. Yeah. It was really a good study in writing.
I love her. And then another great Hamnet, Maggie O'Farrell, mm-hmm. One of my favorite read of this year. I mean, had me in tears, just loved that book. I thought it was fabulous. Book of Longings by Sue Monk-Kidd. Mm-hmm. Another fabulous, fabulous book we read this year. And I try to stay with historical fiction. I've veered out a little bit, but trying to, you know, really focus in on what an author thinks of another author's book in terms of not just plot stuff, but pacing. How's the pacing? What's that character art look like? What false truth did the protagonist believe at the beginning of the story? And what lessons did she or he learn throughout the book that changed him or her at the end? And getting my fans and my folks that follow me to see the writing that way, so that they can then begin to understand why it is they like a book when they read a book and why they don't like a book. Because mm-hmm. the pacings are you're not getting them hooked by the 12% mark, or you're not saving the cat in the beginning, or all the things that I've learned. I try to share those with the members of my book club as we read someone else's work. And, you know, I'm trying to pick authors that do a really good job of that. So I have really good examples to show them. And it's been fun. I have to tell you, I've met some great, great women. And I've got so many women that call me up or email me and say, you know, this is the first book club I've been in, where it's not about food and wine. It's not about chatting about nothing. And it's not just about which plot character did you like, but it really is about the underlying story and the messaging and really about the craft.
The craft is how you craft the title, how you craft the book. There is something amazing about sitting down with authors. A lot of times I sit with them at the thriller conventions and they talk about this. How did you set this up? How did you pull this through? What did you do? Da, da, da. And it's very, very interesting to see how the authors will construct the story. And then they're also helping each other. Like, well, wait a second, don't do that. Move it that way. Or I saw where you got stuck over there. Call me. We'll walk it through. It was very, and it's amazing because everybody gets stuck. And I think that's what everybody has to admit, is we all can get stuck. We all can be in that place. So tell us a little bit more about what you're working on now.
Oh, okay. Well, talking about being stuck, I got two chapters, two intros, two outros, and a cat I have to write. But I'm working on it's a period piece. It's a real story again. It was set in 1872 here in Virginia. And I'm finished, other than, you know, I got to fix two chapters, two intros, two outros, and I got to fix this cat thing. But it's, should I give you the title? Or
sure. Yes, or title, anything about
Veil of, Veil of Doubt. It is a legal drama. It is about a woman who in 1872 was accused of and tried for murdering her four children, her husband, and her aunt in a period of about 2 years. And it's about the attorney who takes on her case. It's got a psychological thriller in a lot of ways. I've had to learn about forensic science and chemistry in 1872. I've had to learn about the legal system in, you know, reconstructed Virginia, about mental health issues and insanity pleas and all these kinds of interesting nuances. And what's really interesting about this story, Carol, and I went into this, honest to God, with not an inkling of this. So I use Ancestry.com to do a lot of my research. I am really interested in the people and when they were born and how many children they had and, you know, when they got married and when their parents died and all these things that help create a person's character and personality. And I was researching my protagonist and I said, okay, he's got these children. I click on the children. And then when I click on one of his daughters, the picture of my house shows up.
Again,
lived here. She was married to the gentleman who rebuilt the house, the main part of the house in 1902. Her name was Lala Harrison White, Lala White, and she lived here from 1902 until she died in the 1940s. Is that like the weirdest coincidence ever? Right?
Yes.
I did not plan this at all. So, but that's this current book. And then right now, I always have two things going on at once, since I'm finishing up this one. This one goes to the publisher at the end of this month for their first round of edits. I'm working on research for another one. It's not titled yet, but it's a sort of a sequel to Mask, but not really. It is Emily and William's story from about 1826 to 1831, when he was named as the Secretary of the Territory of Florida and was the acting governor under William Duval for a while. And it includes and some amazing things that were going on in the territory of Florida during that time period and what led up to the Second Seminole War. So
wow.
I'm pretty excited about that too. It's not Virginia, so it gives me a whole new place to explore. Tallahassee.
But I bet they had dinner there. I bet they had dinner at your house. You're gonna go through something and they knocked on the front door looking for money, trick or treating. they were there for some reason.
I'm sure they were because Jack lived not too far. Yeah.
There you go.
Emily and Charlotte Taylor were sister-in-laws. So yeah, they were here.
They were here. This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. I really enjoyed it.
Yes.
I look forward to seeing what you do next. And I'm going to go back and look at more pictures of the house because people, if you look at the house, that was such a big project to start out with. And to know that there's that much history wrapped up in it. It's just wonderful to see that you didn't start that. Who knows what would happen? You know?
And it's on the cover of the book, as a matter of fact. That is a picture of Armistead that we had painted from a side profile picture. We had an artist named Ron Rundo up in New York with this depiction. So yes, Selma's on the house. And in the book, Carol, you'll notice that my son has drawn pictures of all these historic homes in which the settings take place, the scenes take place. So it's kind of neat to have those as well to look at. So
yeah, people, it's a very rich book. It's a very rich book from a debut author. I'm looking forward to hearing more from. And just remember, you heard it here first. You heard about her here first because there's just so much to explore, you know, everything from what she's been doing, because there's some people that just say, I'm going to write a book, but you really immersed yourself in publishing. And I just absolutely love that about you. So
this is my next career. I got 30 more years, right?
At least. And I still love the artwork as well. I mean, I want to go down. Maybe the problems all these years have been painting with a brush. Maybe I need to go for a knife. I mean, I think that's going to be my problem.
What, knives are really forgiving. I love knife painting. And I'm opening a gallery this spring. So my work will be for sale. And all of the proceeds from my work will go to charity.
Yeah. So that's like wonderful. Historical preservation included, I'm sure. You know,
that's top of the list.
Thanks so much for joining us. Look forward to seeing you soon. And to everyone else, we look forward to seeing you next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Mask of Honor by Sharon Virts, narrated by Jonathan Todd Ross, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Recorded Books. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. Thanks to our research assistant, Catherine Koster. And now listen to an audio excerpt from Mask of Honor, narrated by Jonathan Todd Ross.
Chapter 1. August 15th, 1813, Peach Orchard Camp, Fort Norfolk, Virginia. Lieutenant John Jack Mason McCarty woke with a pounding in his head and a stinging on his neck. Swatting at the biting black fly, he shifted on the cot to find a more comfortable position in the sweltering heat. The movement caused the throbbing in his head to worsen. He rolled onto his back and gulped at the hot, muggy air. The hammering in his head pounded even louder. Bringing a hand to his forehead, Jack grasped his temples. Amid the pulsing pain, a voice boomed somewhere above him. He opened an eye. Blinding rays of filtered light cut through the storm thundering inside his skull. He squinted. A shadowy figure stood over him.
"Get up, Jack!"
The shrillness of the voice compounded the intensity of the throbbing. Jack moaned unintelligibly and squeezed his eyes shut.
"Christ almighty, Jack, you need to get up!"
Jack rolled away toward the tent wall.
"Go away."
"Come on, Jack. Colonel Mason called the officers, and you already missed this morning's roll. Now get up!"
Lieutenant James Delaney kicked the leg of the cot where Jack lay. The thud of James's boot on the cot's wood reverberated through Jack's body like a mallet on a drum.
"Stop that. I'll stop when you get up."
James kicked the cot harder. Jack rolled towards James, his head on fire and his temper beginning to flare.
"For Christ's sake, you are worse than my mother."
James laughed.
"Your mother would have thrown a basin of water on you by now."
Jack grunted.
"Come on, Jack. Up or I'll be forced to turn you out of that cot."
Jack groaned. With a defeated huff, he sat up and steadied himself on the cot's edge. The pulsing in his head made him woozy.
"God, you look awful."
"And a good morning to you too, Sally."
Jack spit a putrid taste from his mouth onto the floor. James shook his head.
"In the lowers again?"
Jack nodded as he rubbed the back of his neck.
"You know how Colonel Mason feels about his officers gambling with enlisted men."
Jack scoffed and spit on the floor again.
"Colonel Mason."
Lifting his head, he glared with bloodshot eyes at his friend. Growing up on neighboring plantations in the Northern Neck, the two had known each other since they were children. Both were members of Virginia's landed gentry, with James's home located along the Potomac River adjacent to General Washington's Mount Vernon, and Jack's family seat situated across the Powhick Bay from his grandfather's plantation of Gunston Hall. Having just reached their 18th years and following in the footsteps of their fathers, who had fought in the Revolution, both were serving as staff officers in this latest war against the British. Like Jack, James was tall, standing just over 6 feet, with broad shoulders that narrowed to a trim waist. His hazel eyes were shaped like almonds and set wide on either side of a long aquiline nose. Normally, James's sable-brown hair was brushed neatly from his face, but this morning his locks were as black as Jack's and glued to his forehead in a sweaty paste. Dressed in full uniform, James was glistening with perspiration. Jack nodded in the direction of James's jacket.
"It must be 100 degrees. Why are you in that?"
"As I said, Colonel Mason's called for us."
"Why?"
James exhaled an exasperated sigh.
"That's what colonels do, Jack. Call their officers, issue orders."
Jack threw James a look.
"But it's Sunday. Even God gave it a rest on Sunday."
"Tell that to the British."
A sudden seriousness darkened Jack's face.
"Are they coming up the river again?"
"Not today, at least not yet. James glanced at the floor before bringing his eyes back to Jack's. Captain Alexander's patrol captured McNally this morning.
Shane?
James nodded.
Jesus.
Shane McNally had grown up on the McCarty family estate, and Jack and James had known him all their lives.
Where?
Dunno, but you need to get cleaned up. The colonel called us at 10.
James pulled a timepiece from his waistcoat.
Which by my watch is in 12 minutes.
Jack lifted his head and drew in a long breath, gathering the wherewithal to stand. James shook his head.
That's what happens when you imbibe that coffin varnish the enlisted men drink.
Jack shot James another dirty look as he stood from the cot. He noticed his boots were still on from the night before. With his first step, Jack stumbled over his hat and nearly fell into the washstand. James reached for Jack's arm to steady him.
Careful there.
James scanned the floor and spotted the coat of Jack's uniform lying half under the cot. He picked it up from the floor and brushed dirt from the sleeve with his hand.
Your quarters are a mess.
Yeah, well.
At the washstand, Jack skimmed dead insects from the basin before pouring more stagnant water from the pitcher. He cupped his hands and splashed his face.
It's not helping, my friend. You still look like hell.
Jack took a handful of water in his mouth and rinsed before spitting it on the floor.
Tastes like something died.
Probably a drowned rat at the bottom of one of those crocs you were drinking from last night. Jack threw another look in James's direction. And when did you become a saint? James laughed.
I'm no saint. I'm just of no mind to punish myself so.
Jack wiped a hand over the stubble on his chin before pushing water from his fingers through his hair. He tucked the shirt into his trousers and straightened his collar.
Do you see my waistcoat?
Glancing around the canvas walls, James spotted the vest on the back of a chair. He grabbed it and tossed it to Jack and watched as Jack struggled to put it on.
I'm worried about you, my friend. Since William left, you've been...
Jack stopped buttoning the waistcoat and glared at James.
Since my brother left, I've been what? Being who I am?
You're not one of the enlisted, Jack.
How do you know what I am?
James lowered his eyes, kicking the toe of his boot into the floor before looking back at Jack, who was still staring at him.
We need to make haste. We don't want to keep Colonel Mason waiting.
Jack scoffed.
That man has little patience for anything.
James remained silent while Jack finished dressing, and the two exited the stifling heat of the tent. What once had been rows of fruited trees surrounded by mounds of grass and golden mustard were now axed stumps engulfed in powdered dirt that turned to thick black mud when it rained. Built to protect Fort Norfolk's flank, Peach Orchard Camp was a mix of tents and log cabins aligned in a grid, with officers' quarters near the gate and enlisted men's at the rear. Far from the eyes of the officers were shelters along the camp's rear earthen wall. Jack was all too familiar with the lowers, where jugs of grog were plentiful and games of hazard could be found on any given night. With little breeze stirring and the August sun baking overhead, the temperature outside was oppressive, the air pungent with fetid odors of men and death. The suffocating misery of heat and sickness was routine in the lowlands along the Elizabeth River. During the day, biting flies and swarming gnats tortured the encamped soldiers. At night, it was mosquitoes that plagued them. But their greatest source of suffering came from boredom and a longing for home. As Jack and James made their way across camp, a wagon carrying the bodies of two men kicked up a cloud of dust as it rolled by on its way to the grave pit. Jack pulled a handkerchief from his pocket and covered his nose and mouth, fighting to keep from losing his stomach. He had been told that he would get used to the smell, but he had not. The officers of the 56th Regiment of Virginia's militia had gathered outside their commanding officer's quarters. As Jack and James approached, Major George Rust, with dark, deep-set eyes, gave Jack a once-over and a disapproving look. Jack lowered his gaze and fell in with the others waiting in the hot summer sun for the colonel to emerge. When the last officer had joined the group, Captain Gerard Alexander leaned through the doorway of the log cabin and called inside. Within moments, Colonel Armistead Mason stepped from the shadows, the epaulettes on his shoulders and the buttons on his dark blue coat glimmering in the hazy sunshine. His trousers were white and crisply pressed, and his black boots polished to a high gloss. A round hat, tilted to the left with a black cockade, covered most of his auburn hair. Despite the sweltering heat, there was not a visible drop of sweat on the colonel. He gleamed in the morning light, every part of his appearance in perfect order. At his emergence, the officers saluted. Jack, too, straightened his shoulders and raised his right hand to his temple. "At ease, gentlemen, at ease." The men relaxed their salute, but the tension was as thick as the sweltering air. Colonel Mason cleared his throat and scanned their weathered faces. "Upon my arrival here 2 weeks ago, this regiment was in complete disarray. My first priority has been to establish order and instill discipline among the men. As you would expect, not all are happy with the rigor of military doctrine. Last week, three of these dissenters abandoned their posts and absconded from camp. Desertion, gentlemen, next to insubordination, is the greatest enemy of an army, and I will tolerate neither." Colonel Mason removed his hat from his head and tucked it under his arm. Pulling a handkerchief from his pocket, he dabbed his hairline. "He sweats after all," Jack thought, as the colonel pushed the handkerchief across his forehead and back into his pocket. "Captain Alexander's patrol apprehended one of the deserters this morning and has returned the man to camp." Colonel Mason turned to Gerard Alexander. "Well done, Captain, well done indeed." The colonel outstretched his hand to shake the captain's as officers nodded. Gerard Alexander, who was sporting an ear-to-ear grin, reminded Jack of an obedient puppy waiting for a bone and a pat on the head. "Gentlemen," Colonel Mason said, his brown eyes nearly black with intensity, "we must set an example among the men that desertion will not be tolerated." Jack's stomach tightened into knots. The Federal Army has experienced these same issues and has implemented policy to execute absconders. Since then, desertion has largely ceased in the Federal ranks. Now, their regiments in the Northern Campaign are stronger than ever against the enemy. I have studied these methods and discussed it with General Taylor and the Governor. We all agree on the need for a firm hand. The knot in Jack's gut began to twist. Officers shifted their stances and exchanged glances. Major Rust cleared his throat and broke the silence.
"Are you suggesting, sir, that we execute McNally?"
"I'm not making a suggestion, Major. I'm issuing an order. Once Captain Alexander convenes a firing squad, we shall muster the men onto the quad and execute the private as an example to the others."
"You can't be serious."
The words flew from Jack's mouth before his lips had time to stop them. Colonel Mason tilted his head in Jack's direction.
"Excuse me, Lieutenant."
"McNally is 16 years old, Colonel. He's not a soldier, but a boy."
James moved behind Jack and squeezed Jack's elbow in warning. Colonel Mason's dark eyes narrowed.
"Who asked you to speak? Are you questioning my authority, Lieutenant?"
Colonel Mason scanned Jack from head to toe.
"Look at yourself. You're completely out of order."
"Colonel Mercer would never have issued such a command," Jack said, feeling blood rush up his neck, desperate to do something, anything to intervene.
"Colonel Mercer isn't in charge here anymore, now is he?"
Colonel Mason snapped.
"Might I remind you that Colonel Mercer was too sick to command? Not that he was effective in leading his regiment in good health either."
Captain Alexander snickered under his breath at Colonel Mason's insult as the other officers exchanged cautionary glances. An angry flush spread from Jack's neck to his face.
Colonel Charles Fenton Mercer, a mentor and friend, had recruited Jack into the regiment, and Jack had served as both Mercer's aide-de-camp and his personal secretary. By all accounts, Fenton Mercer was brilliant and had taught Jack more than any teacher he'd ever known. James increased his grip on Jack's elbow. Jack shrugged free as Major Rust interceded.
Colonel, I believe Lieutenant McCarty's reaction is representative of the response we may receive from the entire regiment should we execute McNally, as you suggest. It's not that I nor any one of the officers question your orders, sir, but such punishment will most certainly erode morale and could possibly incite desertion en masse, or worse, mutiny. With all due respect, Colonel, I believe we should be measured in this instance. Punish the soldier, yes. But having him face a firing squad without knowing the consequence of his actions beforehand may be considered extreme.
Colonel Mason fixed his pensive eyes on the Major. The Major stared back, unwavering. Not a word was uttered, and the silence between the two men grew awkward. Another long minute passed before Colonel Mason shifted his eyes away from Major Rust to a point beyond the camp. Then Colonel Mason nodded, seemingly to himself, before looking back at the Major.
Very well, then, Colonel Mason said. He pinched his shoulders and straightened his posture before looking back at his officers. Colonel Mercer's lack of leadership is at fault here. Had he provided proper training and adequate discipline, we would not have such insubordinate behavior and the ensuing morale issue.
Colonel Mason paused his lecture and raised his voice to declare his verdict. McNally shall be lashed. Going forward, should he or any man abscond from their post, they shall be executed. Let this be the first and final warning. Deserters will be hunted down and dragged back to camp to stand before a firing squad. Might I remind each and every one of you that my father, like your fathers, sacrificed greatly to free this country from the tyranny of the British. And we, gentlemen, have been called once again to face the enemy. It is kill or be killed, and we shall not relinquish our responsibility. The responsibility to defend Virginia and to preserve our nation's freedom. With sweat now glowing on his brow, Colonel Mason again removed the handkerchief from his pocket and wiped his forehead before returning the hat to his head.
Captain Alexander, order every man to the quad to witness the lashing of Private McNally.
Jack squinted, shading his eyes from the blistering sun with a hand while he watched them drag Shane McNally to the quad. Shane seemed small as he stumbled through the dust, his face smudged and scratched, his ginger hair dirty and matted. There was fear in his eyes, but he shed not a tear as his hands were tied to the post. Stay strong, Shane, Jack thought, as the boy's soiled shirt was pulled from his shoulders and left hanging from the waist of his trousers. As Captain Alexander raised the whip, Jack turned his head. At the first whistle and crack of the lash, Jack closed his eyes. When the whip cracked on the boy's back a second time, Jack flinched. The whip whistled and cracked again. Shane McNally screamed. Jack clenched a fist and held it close at his side. Stay strong.
Whack!
Shane McNally began to cry, pleading for forgiveness. With his eyes still closed, Jack shook his head and clutched his fist tighter. Don't beg, Shane. They won't forgive you.
Whack!
Shane screamed again. Jack dug his thumb into the side of his leg as he clenched his fingers tighter and tighter, remembering the feel of the leather strap and his own warm blood running down his side before the world had gone white.